This is videotape number 27, Unix assembly codes development for vulnerabilities illustration purposes.
Let's start right now. I'd like to welcome everybody to this presentation. My name is Tomasz Ostwald, and I'm a member of Last Stage of Delirium Research Group, which will help this presentation. Traditionally, we'll start with... Oh, sorry. Good? No. I will take it. Okay. Traditionally, we'll start with just a few words about our team. We are a non-profit and rather informal organization established in 1996 in Poland, aimed especially at various research and gaining practical experience in network and computer security. At this moment, there are four official members of our team. Along with me, this presentation will be heard by Adam Gowdiak, and the remaining two LSD guys, Michał Chmielewski and Sergiusz von Roberts, should be wandering somewhere in the background at the moment. We are all graduated of computer science from Poznan University of Technology, and at the moment, for last 5 or 6 years, we've been working as a security and Tiger team for Poznan Supercomputing at the Networking Center. Okay, just a few words about our general fields of activity. We started with research for new vulnerabilities and new general attack techniques with some more complex analysis of various stuff. However, from the very beginning, we were not limited to some theoretical divagations, but also were involved in more practical activities like developing various proof of concept codes and general methodologies. However, at this very point, these are not our only efforts. This is not the only stream of our activity. We are involved in several projects, also independent, but also in cooperation with various entities, like aimed at analysis of available security solutions and general defense methodologies, development of various tools, mainly for reverse engineering, and various experiments with distributed host-based intrusion detection systems and other security-related stuff, like, for example, analysis of non-technical aspects of security, for example, practical consequences of social engineering techniques. Short overview of this presentation. It will be divided in two parts. In the first part, the first part will be at very general level. We'll try to present some basic introduction to the problems we will discuss later, introduce some basic concepts required to the second part. In the second part, we will focus mainly on some technical, purely technical aspects of the problem. At the end, we assume some time for questions and possible discussions. At this point, we would like to say that due to the limitation of this presentation, it's short time relatively, we had to make some very general simplifications and make it at various different levels. With this presentation in your conference materials, you will find accompanying paper where much more of technical details of this presentation are described. There you can also find some amount of code, which is also reflects what we are discussing here. I'm not sure, in the materials there are probably not the latest versions, and the latest and updated are always available from our website, LSD Planet. Okay. Next, just a bit about our motivations. I don't think I have to convince anybody here that practical security is based both on knowledge about protections as well as knowledge about the threats. In other ways, if anyone wants to attack a computer system, he needs knowledge about its protection mechanisms and their possible limitations. And contrary, if one wants to defend his systems, he should be aware of attack techniques, their real capabilities, and possible impact. However, as the security mechanisms are widely spoken, promoted, advertised with some irresistible guarantees for security level and so on, and well documented, except of course for the practical limitations. The technical details of attack methodologies and real threats they represent are still not well discussed, not well documented, and in our opinion there is a significant need for open research in the area and making the results of such research publicly available for all interested parties. Why? Because we all know that such research is continuously conducted by various entities for years. And of course, with some different purposes in mind. In our opinion, this kind of knowledge, this kind of information about vulnerabilities, about attack techniques, about limitations of security mechanisms, these are the information which should be publicly available. This is the only way to promote security and increase practical security. We will back to this problem at the end of our presentation. So let's move to the first part directly related to this presentation. So what is this all about? During this presentation, we were talking about the assembly components. As the assembly components, we understand these little pieces of assembly code which are used in various exploits, proof of concepts, codes written to illustrate a specific vulnerability. The need for using such assembly components in practice appeared with buffer overflow exploitation techniques. Previously, there was no need for such pieces, or it was very limited. From these days, these codes evaluated both in the sense of the available functionality, which significantly increased, as well as their complexity and optimization techniques. In our opinion, from some point of view, these little components might be considered as the crucial elements of proof of concept codes. Some short characteristics of these codes. In this presentation, we focus only on assembly codes used in active attacks. These assembly components can be used in proof of concept codes for low level class of security vulnerabilities, the ones that allow for the redirection of a program execution by means of PPC register modifications. These components are very static entities, in fact. These are components can be copied and pasted to various exploits and used several times. What's more, the actual functionality of these components obviously differs. However, the required functionality can be usually combined through application, through modification and applying of proper code blocks. Okay, based on our experiences, we prepared a simplified functional specification for such assembly components. This led us to, I would repeat also, simplified functionality, taxonomy of functionality for these components. We are fully aware that there are many different possibilities, that there are different functional range that can be used. However, during this presentation, we will focus on these specific types of assembly components. The first two types are the most simple, the most common assembly components. It's simple shellcode and command shellcode, respectively for shell execution or single command executions. The following one, the privilege restoration components and change root limited environment escapes components, are used for bypassing security mechanisms imposed on given process. The fifth and sixth, it is bind socket code and find socket code, are these components which are used usually in remote attacks and which are used in establishing interactive communication with hacked systems. The last two types of components, it is jump and knob, as the exploit-specific ones. We'll not discuss them we'll discuss them very briefly during this presentation. All the others will be discussed right now in more detail. Okay, we'll start the most common and most well-known and used in practice types of assembly components. This is obviously the shellcode. Here you can find the C equivalents of both shellcode and command shellcode, which is used for execution of single command. These are components which are used in most currently available local exploits. However, we prefer to talk about not only shellcodes or something like this, but rather to this general family of assembly components. Simple as the talking about shellcode is only the specific example of assembly component which can be used in exploit, proof of concept code, and so on. And just calling all this stuff as shellcodes would be a very significant limitations. The exploit doesn't have end up with shell execution, doesn't have end up with execution of a given command, modifying of any file, and so on. It can perform, in fact, any operation in the system. And this is the reason, for example, why dropping privileges while executing new binary image in the process is not, in fact, the actual protection, but it's only difficulty which can be bypassed. Okay, let's move to third type of assembly components. It is privileges restorations components. In some cases, in some root suites, there are use mechanisms for a temporal reduction of effective or real privileges. This mechanism is designed in this way that the most vulnerable parts of the program are executed with the least privileges required. So the potential attacks doesn't have this tragic impact. If properly applied, this general privileges reduction mechanism can be very effective against classical attacks based, for example, on errors in file systems like race conditions or symlinks. However, if in case of buffer overflow or string formats techniques when assembly components come in use, the privileges can be always restored, often restored, unless they are completely dropped by a vulnerable program. Okay. Here we can find, have a look at previous restoration functions at various operating systems. So to make a short summary of this privileges assembly components, we do assume that any additional privileges control mechanism providing the functionality of temporal and selective enabling or disabling of privileges can be often bypassed when confronted with buffer overflow or format string attack techniques. The good example may be capabilities mechanism defined in POSIX 1E, where suite binaries usually require specific set of privileges and reducing all the other ones. The example of such capabilities can be CapDuckWrite capabilities, which allows access to any file in the file system without even against access control series or set it right. And such reducting privileges can be also often bypassed by properly prepared assembly component. The other one example of limiting environment is change root environment common in Unix systems used for reducing visibility of the tree structure. It is also, this mechanism is also ineffective when the intruder is able to perform, able to execute code with root privileges. And with such privileges, he can usually escape from the change root limited environment. I will try to explain how it works. In fact, it may be a bit tough for me, especially in English. However, it may be a good preparation for the second part. For every process in the system, there are associated two virtual nodes, respectively for root directory and for current directory. These are this RDIR and CDIR. In our example, both set to slash TMP. Let's suppose that attacker took control of our system and try to bypass the limited change root environment. For this, as I said, the actual root privileges are required. Just to do it, an attacker had to create a new directory and use the change root function with this new directory as an argument. The actual cheating of the operating system mechanism is based in a verification for root directory. This is usually made in OS kernel lookup procedure, which compares all virtual nodes from the path to the given file system object with the actual defined root directory. In our case, comparisons are failed, and the actual directory can be changed to the single slash. The last comment, change root dot, just sets both root directory and current root directory to the slash. And in fact, the change root limited environment protection is bypassed at this moment. Now let's move to the slightly different problem. We are moving to the fifth and sixth types of assembly components, which are used for getting access to remote systems, which has been hacked, for example, usually by a vulnerability in a network service. Historically, the first way was the execution of single comment in the remote system, or semicolon separated sequence of comments. However, such approach has very rigid and very significant disadvantages. First of all, only one or limited number of executed comments can be performed. But it's also the most important disadvantage from the attacker perspective, is no user interactions, no output, no results about the actual actions taken in the systems. The command buffer size is always additional limitations. These are the reasons why very often, very common is that very sophisticated exploits, exploiting very hard vulnerabilities, are ends up with rather pathetic activities in the operating system. This was the main reason why the bind socket code was developed. It was simple, aimed at establishing a network server in the hacked system with listening socket. And after a new connections from the attacker system is established with the socket, the interactive shell is spawned. Just before the connection socket descriptions is duplicated to standard in and standard out. However, this approach to the communication with hacked remote systems has also significant limitations, with, among which the most important are that server code may not be reached due to firewall or intrusion prevention systems. Also, due to popularity of network-based intrusion detection systems, such activities can be usually very easily notified by intrusion detection systems. It was the main motivations for designing the brand new solution for communication with hacked-gained systems, which main advantage is that it doesn't require a connection to another port. It is simple, based on the same connection to the vulnerable service, which is used during an actual attack. In this approach, the assembly component is executed in the context of exploited process. Therefore, you get this assembly component has access to all descriptors, including descriptors for TCP connections. Through duplicating of TCP socket descriptor to standard in, standard out, standard error, and spawning interactive shell, the communication with this with hacked server can be performed with the same TCP connection. However, in this very case, the additional parameters of the connection are required. These are get through application of get peer name function executed in the loop on set of descriptions and looking for actual TCP connection. In fact, the source port number. The same thing is at the client side. The source port of a connection to the to the server established in hacked system must be obtained. This is usually done by using get sock name functions, and in case of some older some operating systems which doesn't have implemented network interface as a dedicated set of syscalls, it can be done like for example old Solaris or Santa Cruz operating system. It can be done through equivalent EOCTL operations. The find socket and code is general useful for exploitation of various vulnerabilities in network services. However, it is especially useful in case of RPC services. In this specific case, the source port is obtained through proper call to client TCP create functions. What can be said about the overall functionality of this find socket code? Its main advantage is that using this such components, such assembly components, and access to very highly protected servers can be gained. For example, using the byte TSIC overflow vulnerability and with applied find socket code, you can get full control of the DNS server located in the demilitarized zone with a very rigid and strict configuration of firewall system. These last two assembly types of assembly components we've been presenting. Just to introduce, the buffer overflow techniques as well as format string techniques usually requires some very heuristic behavior of exploit codes as they are supposed to work on different operating systems independent from the current configuration or environmental settings. For these reasons, these assembly components are often used, are often very useful in developing proof of concept codes. However, as it is not the actual subject of this presentation, I will skip this point. as I can see, we are just a little behind the our assumed schedule for the presentation. The first part was to be completed at this point. I will skip this part, aimed and short introduction to various processor architectures. We do assume some basic knowledge in this field, and I will just make a very fast forward presentation, and just to make an overall list of processor architectures that will be discussed in the core second part of our presentations. This presentation is mainly focused on RISC processors, as we find them, as in my opinion, they seem less well known and discussed in the context of security. We also refer in our presentation and in our everyday work rather to operate to RISC processors. However, if you were to count operating systems for CISC and RISC processors, then the amount would be probably equal. I will let myself skip this slide. As I told you, all these presentations, as well as more detailed paper, is available from our website. There is always the newest version, and we try to update it and enrich it with various new parts. Historically, the first RISC architecture, which was analyzed by our group, was MIPS, MIPS processors. Here, or rather in your materials, you will find some basic characteristics of these processors. And here is presented some basic abstract binary interface and register specialization for MIPS architectures. I will also skip it. The next architecture that will be discussed in the second part is Spark. Here you can find the short characteristics of these processors, a very short overview of abstract binary interface. The next processor architectures we're focused on is a RISC used by HPUX operating systems. And again, very short overview of ABI. The next architecture is a Power PC and Power used in AIX operating systems. Again. And the last process architecture we also discuss briefly in the second part is Alpha microprocessor in the specific context of Alteryx operating systems. At this point, we are closing this first part, this more general, more introduction one. The second part, which we do consider as the actual core of our presentation, will be focused on the practical, technical details of developing various types of assembly components in various operating systems, working on various processor architectures that I have presented in this fast-forward introductions. This section will be heard by my friend Adam.
Excuse us for a moment, we just change places. Okay. So at this point, I assume that you have some basic backgrounds of processor architectures and that you know exactly what kind of assembly routines we are going to talk about. Before I proceed with the code details, I would like to give you a brief introduction to the idea of a system call interface. As you probably know, every operating system is designed in a layered architecture, and there are two primary layers, which are appropriately the kernel layer and the user layer. The kernel layer provides the main functionality of the operating system, and the user layer consists of system libraries and application programs. And these are these two layers that make up an operating system. The functionality of our assembly components is obtained mainly by invoking the operating system services, and these services are implemented in the kernel layer, and the only way the user applications can call these services is through the concept of a system caller interface. If an application wants to call operating system services, it must issue, make use of a hardware-supported, some kind of a hardware-supported mechanism, and this is usually implemented in the form of some special instruction or trap instruction. And different computer architectures have different system call instructions, the instructions that are used for invoking operating system services. But these system call instructions and that mechanism, it is common for every operating system, every processor architecture. Upon the execution of such a special instruction, the control is passed to the kernel mode to the appropriate system service routine. So now I think I can give you much more detailed information about the mechanism and the system call invocation mechanisms that are used on a given RISC architectures. So we'll start with the IRIX MIPS. This is the first and historically the first system that we've dealt with. On IRIX MIPS, a syscall special instruction must be issued in order to call operating system services. And it is required that register V0, the mode, is filled with a given system call number, and registers, argument registers from 0 to 3 are appropriately filled with the values for a given system call. And what's interesting for this IRIX MIPS syscall instruction is that it contains 30 bytes in its encoding, and as we always try to avoid 0 bytes in our assembly routines due to the characteristics of the buffer overflow and formatting vulnerabilities, the way they are usually exploited, the way they occur because of some string-related function, improper use of some string-related functions. We try to avoid the 0 bytes, and in the case of the syscall instruction, we just simply set some arbitrary bits in this instruction. So it still remains a syscall instruction, but it doesn't contain any 0 bytes anymore. So the next slide shows you a detailed information about the system call services that we use in our assembly routines. In the first column, you can see the system, the names of the system call functions, and the other columns contain appropriately the system call numbers and the arguments. For example, the execv system call function requires a hexadecimal value of 3F3 in the V0 register and a pointer to a path to the binary that is to be executed, that is in register A0, and a pointer to the table of pointers containing as a first at its first index the pointer to that the same path. On Spark, we don't have any special syscall invocation instruction. We just have to make use of a software trap invocation instruction, that is the TA8 trap instruction. Upon calling the operating system services, we got to put a given system call number of the required system call routine in global register 1, and we have to appropriately field the output registers from 0 to 4 with appropriate given, with a given system call arguments. Again, we see here a similar table, a reference table for system call functions. This time it is for Solaris Spark. As you can see, it is rather similar to the MIPS one. And what's interesting here is that due to some rather strange implementation of the network interface on Solaris, that is remaining from some older Solaris versions, that is 2.5 version, we got additional arguments that must be passed to the network functions, that is, for example, socket creation function and bind function. On HPUX, running on PA RISC, we got another system call invocation mechanism. We call operating system services by making a so-called inter-segment jump call. And this is a jump call which passes execution straightly to the kernel code, to the kernel routine. And you see here on the slide a simple two-instruction sequence that implements such a inter-segment jump call instruction. The first instruction loads register 1 with the offset of the kernel routine to which we are going to go, and the second instruction is in fact that inter-segment jump call, and it is a branch extending instruction which jumps through register shadow register 7, which maps a piece of kernel address space. And we got one additional argument here to the branch extending instruction, that is that register 1, which contains the offset value of the routine to which we are going to go. As always, we have to pass some arguments to the system call routine, and this is in this HPUX case, we have to fill register 22 with a given system call number and registers 26 to 23 with appropriate arguments. And once again, we see here similar system call reference table for HPUX. What is interesting here is that the arguments to system call routines are taken from registers, but have a look that they are taken in reverse order. So the first argument goes in register 26 and the last one goes in register 23. And what's also quite interesting here is that although the execv function requires two arguments for its execution, we don't need to provide it in fact with that second argument. So we just need to fill the register 26 with a pointer to the path of a binary that is to be executed, and the shell execution routine will still be working. And by doing so, we can save many bytes from that shell execution routine, and I guess that our shell execution routine is one of the shortest ones, at least for RISC architectures. So now, this is AIX and PowerPC. Its operating system services are called with the use of SVCA, special instruction, and this is a minimum ink notation of power. And for PowerPC, this is SC instruction, but we usually use the power mnemonic notation as that was the first architecture that we in fact met with on AIX. When calling system services on an AIX, we got to fill register 2 with appropriate system call number that identifies a given system call routine, and registers from the 3rd to 10th must be filled with appropriate arguments. What's interesting here that there are two additional requirements that must be fulfilled in order to successfully perform a system call on AIX, we got to fill the link register with the so-called return from syscall address. This is the address to which the execution will be passed upon the return from the syscall routine, system call routine. And we got one more requirement, that is the usage of a C0C instruction that must be issued just before the system call invocation instruction. Again, we see here a system call reference table, this time for AIX. And as you know, AIX is pretty weird because it has different system call numbers for across different operating system versions, and this is for the same system call services. So, for example, we got different system call number for AIX41, another system call number for AIX42, and another for AIX43. And we tried to find out some rules that would allow us implement fairly universal assembly components for different AIX operating versions, but we just simply failed. You know, IBM folks are just pretty random when it comes to extending operating system services and to choosing their numbers. Okay, this is the last one from the RISC architecture that I'm gonna tell you something about. On Alpha Ultrix, we got a special COPAL instruction that is used for calling operating system services. We got to fill register V0 with an appropriate system call number, identifying a given system call routine, and registers A0 to A5 with appropriate arguments for a given system call. And we see here an alpha system call reference table. You see this is pretty small. We haven't developed any more assembly components for alpha, just simple shell execution and set RAUID routines. This is mainly due to the fact that on alpha it is rather difficult to exploit certain buffer overflow or format string vulnerabilities, due to the fact that it is a 64-bit architecture, a little endian architecture, and its address space contain a lot of zeros, so it is rather difficult to fulfill all the conditions that are required to overwrite a PC counter resistant exploit a given vulnerability on alpha. So now I'll give you a short overview of the Intel-based operating systems and the system call invocation mechanism that are used on these systems. We'll start with the Solaris and Santa Cruz operation. You might expect that the same processor architecture should induce some kind of a common system call invocation mechanism, but this is not in fact true. We got different system call invocation mechanisms on different Intel-based operating systems. On Solaris and Santa Cruz operation, that is Unixware and Open Server, we got an LCall 7.0 instruction, which is in fact a far call instruction through a system call callgate selector, which passes execution to the kernel routine. Upon issuing that instruction, we got to fill register EAX with appropriate system call number, identifying a given routine we want to invoke. And what's interesting here is that unless on RISC architectures we had system call arguments always passed through registers, here we see that the arguments to the system call to the system call routine are passed through stack, and in this specific case we got them passed in reverse order, so the first system call argument is pushed as the last value on stack. And there is one additional requirement for the Solaris and Santa Cruz operation systems that must be fulfilled before calling operating system services. We got there must be one additional value pushed on the stack just before issuing the LCall instruction. So this table shows exactly the stack order of arguments that must be met in order to properly call a given system call service. You can clearly see here that on top of the stack we got that dummy write instruction, of which use we don't know exactly why it is there, but it is required in order to call a system call service. For BSD family of systems, that is OpenBSD, FreeBSD, NetBSD running on Intel x86, we got also the same LCall 70 call instruction that is used on Solaris, and additionally we got another mechanism that can be used for calling the system, and this is the software interrupt number 80, hexadecimal 80 number. We got similar like on Solaris, we got register EIX field to the system call number, and arguments are passed through stack in reverse order, just the same as it was the case for Solaris and Santa Cruz operation system. And you see it here that we again have one additional value pushed on the stack just before issuing the LCall instruction. I guess there's nothing interesting here on this slide. It is the same as for Solaris and Santa Cruz operation. So I'll pass to the Linux operating system. You see, on Linux, a software interrupt instruction known from BSD systems is used for calling the operating system service. Register EAX is also filled with a system call number, just like on BSD systems, but this is where all similarities between Linux and BSD systems end, because the actual arguments to system call services are passed to the kernel routine through registers, that is register EBX, ECX, and EDX. Okay, I'll skip that slide again. And this is the last operating system. BIOS is the last operating system, Intel-based operating system, for which we have developed our assembly components. On BIOS, again, a software interrupt instruction is used for calling the system services, and in this case, it is interrupt number 25 in hex. Register EIX is again filled with a system call number, and arguments are also passed through stack and also in reverse order. And what's interesting is that on BIOS we got two additional values pushed on the stack that must be there before invoking a given system call. We got a dummy library return address that is known from Solaris on running on Intel. And also we got another value that must be pushed on the stack, and that value indicates the number of arguments that are in fact passed to the system call routine. You see here the system call reference table for BIOS. It is pretty small because we just failed to find proper information on how to implement network operations with a system call interface. We just didn't find proper information on that issue, so we just managed to write simple shell execution routine for BIOS. So I come now to another issue, to the position independent code issue. You know, among several requirements that we wanted that our coders would fulfill, there were the one that would that emerged as a result of a need for code that would be able to start executing at unknown memory location and without that would be able to access its own data without any prior knowledge about that initial location. And that feature of our codes is called, of course, position independence. You know, it isn't fairly difficult to write position independent code. It may be difficult when position independence is mixed with a 0-3 code requirement. So you just have to construct instructions in such a way that they do not contain zero byte values. You know, position independent code is usually able to locate itself in memory, and it is usually shorter, as we notice, and free from any constraints that are imposed on the knowledge or even validity of the initial register values that are used in the code for proper reconstruction or for referencing a given code's data. The rule that we always try to use when developing such position independence instruction sequences, that we always try to use whatever mechanism available, and we always try to do it in the shortest possible way. Now I'll give you a brief overview of the position independent instructions on how we obtain position independence in our assembly routines. We'll start with a MIPS microprocessor. On MIPS, we just need one instruction to obtain a current value of a program counter register. As you know, in order to write position independent code, you just have at some known point in your program, you just got to obtain a value of a program counter register. And this BLTZAL instruction from MIPS does it. This is a branch less than zero and link instruction. It makes a branch if it's operand value, and in this specific case a zero value register. If its operand value is less than zero, and if this is the case, the branch is taken. And of course, zero is no less than zero, so the branch is not taken in this specific case, but the link is done, and by making a link, we just get the current value of the program counter register in RA register, that is the return address register of MIPS. And as a result of executing this instruction, the memory location of label plus 8 address is stored in that return address register, MIPS return address register, and this is not the label plus 4 address as on MIPS. Every branch is supposed to be followed by a branch delay slot instruction, and this is why that branch delay slot instruction has been counted in that result address. On Spark, it is fairly, we got to use some fairly tricks to obtain a given a current value of a program counter register, and we use this three instruction sequence. We make use of a branch never and annulate instruction that which is accompanied usually by a call instruction. So I'll tell you how it works. The first branch never instruction, because it is a branch never instruction, does not make a branch. So the next instruction is supposed to be executed, but it doesn't get executed because the first branch never instruction has an A suffix. This is an annulate suffix. So the second branch instruction isn't also taken. So this is the third call instruction. This that does get executed, and it jumps to the second branch never instruction, and again the branch is not taken. We got an annulate suffix, and we omit the call instruction. We do not execute the call instruction for the second time due to that A suffix of the second branch never instruction, and a result of that instruction sequence, we obtain a value of label plus 12 address in output register 7. That value gets loaded to that register upon the execution of a call instruction. What's interesting is that on Spark we don't have to issue such a three instruction sequence in order to obtain a current value of a program counter register. We just need to issue an RD instruction that reads current value of a program counter register to a specified operand register. PA risk is no different than IRIX. As you can see, we also use a branch and link instruction in order to obtain a current value of a program counter register. But in this specific case, we jump forward, not backwards. And the jump is made to the next instruction, the one that is immediately following that PL instruction. And as a result, we get the address of memory location that is labeled +4, that it gets stored in a register rec that is specified as a operand of that branch and link instruction. On Power and Power PC, we again have to make some long instruction sequence to issue some long instruction sequence in order to obtain current value of a program counter register. It cannot be done with a single instruction as it could yield 0 byte of codes and instruction encoding. In this specific Power PC and Power case, we first issue an exclusive OR operation that sets the equality bit in a condition register field 0. Next, we try to issue branch not equal and link instruction, that is BNEL instruction. And that instruction does take a branch if that previously set equality state in a condition register field bit is not set, but in our case it is set, so that branch is not taken, but the link is done, although the branch is not taken, and we get current value of a program counter register in a link register, special register of AIX, of PowerPC and Power architecture. And because that link register cannot be used in any memory references instruction, that is, in any load or store instructions, we got to move it with a MFLR instruction to any general purpose register, what is also done in this case. Alpha is also strange when it comes to obtaining current value of a program counter register. On alpha, we make use of a jump to and return from subroutine instructions. We try to build to make a jump to a subroutine and then return from the subroutine. And to do that, we build a RET 0 RA 1 instruction in the stack and jump through it. So as you can see, the first LDA instructions load register 1 with an opcode value of that RET 0 instruction, and the second, the third instruction, that is store a long instruction, stores that opcode value of the RET 0 instruction in a given stack location. Next, we load register 2 with an address of the that RET 0 instruction, and we just simply jump to that address using a jump to subroutine instruction. By making a jump, we jump to the subroutine, and which contains one return from subroutine instruction. And when the jump is taken, we got register 2 filled with a jump +4 address loaded. On Intel, it is fairly easy to obtain a given value of a program counter register. Usually you just have to use a simple call forward instruction, but that of course would yield a 0 byte opcode in the instruction encoding. So we make first a jump call forward within a relative offset, 8-bit relative offset to the call instruction, then make a backward call to the pop instruction. And by doing that call, the return from subroutine address is push on the stack, we then execute a pop instruction that backloads that return from subroutine address to any given register, general purpose register, which can be later used in our current code for referencing its own data. And as a result of executing this instruction sequence on Intel, we get the address of memory location that is labeled plus 5 getting stored in register rack. Sometimes we don't even have to issue that jump forward, call backward, and pop instruction sequence. It is fairly sufficient that we push some value on stack. We can construct our own data on stack by pushing appropriate values in it, and by addressing that values with a simple move to general purpose register instruction from the stack pointer register, or by pushing appropriate stack pointer register on stack. But this is all dependent from the actual system call, the convention mechanism used for system call passing, for passing the arguments to the system calls. Now I will just very fast go through register specific operations. In our codes, register operations are definitely the ones that are used the most frequently, and we always try to select register operations in such a way that a given operation is always executed in the shortest possible way. And in this MIPS case, you see here, for example, when we want to load a 16-bit constant into a register, we just used a simple load immediate instruction. When you want to load 8-bit constants into registers, we just have to issue two instruction sequence, and this is mainly due to the zero byte avoiding problem. The first load immediate instruction loads a given register with a reference value, and that reference value is usually used in the second computational instruction, which in effect calculates the target 8-bit value you want to obtain in a destination register. In this example, we want to obtain a value of 36 in register T5, so we make use of the register S0, which is loaded with 400, and by adding a negative value of 400 minus 36, we get a 36 value on register T5. On Spark, again, we have very similar operations, register-specific operations, as on MIPS. Please notice that on Spark, we can freely load 8-bit constants into registers, as we can use Spark move operation for that purpose. But contrary to MIPS, we can't make use of the dedicated zero register, Spark zero register, for obtaining zero values in other general purpose registers. We just have to issue appropriate logical end operation for that purpose. PRISC is no more different than the previously discussed architectures. What is maybe interesting here is that 8-bit constants can be also freely loaded on that architecture, but it can be done with a load immediate or any move operation. For that purpose, we have to issue appropriate add immediate operation, and we have to obtain zero value registers by issuing appropriate exclusive OR operation. You can't make use of the PRISC dedicated hardwired zero register here due to the zero byte avoiding problem. Power and PowerPC. That architecture has some pretty several special registers. which in fact can't be used in some common operations like memory referencing operations. So we often use move from and move to special register operations that move values between special registers and general purpose registers on PowerPC. When we want to load a 16-bit constant into register, we issue the same load immediate instruction as on MIPS. 8-bit constant also have to be loaded into registers. Like on MIPS, we have to issue two instruction sequence. The first one usually loads a given reference register with a given reference value, and the second one is used whenever we want to calculate a target 8-bit constant in a given register. PowerPC has also some quite nice operation for decrementing register value, that is add immediate with a negative one given as a operand. When we want to move values between registers, we just have to issue move register instruction. It can be done in other way. And also, like in PA risk case, we have to issue an exclusive OR operation whenever we need to obtain a zero value in a given register, because PowerPC and Power architecture doesn't support any hardwired dedicated zero register. For alpha, we got very same things here. Whenever we want to load a 32-bit constant into register, we issue consecutive two load address instructions. The first loads a 16-bit high nibble of a given register with a given value. The second one loads the low 16-bit nibble of a given register with a given value. I'll skip that. Okay. On Intel, Intel as a CISC processor has some handy instructions for register operations. We usually make use of DEC, DEC and INC instructions for decrementing or incrementing register values. And what's interesting here is that CDQL instruction, which is a convert double to quote word instruction, and is in fact a sign extension instruction that extends that does a sign extension of a 32-bit constant into a 62-bit one. When this instruction is appropriately used, it can be nicely used for obtaining a zero value in an EDX register. Now I'll give you just very fast overview of the instructions that are used by us for preparing and addressing data in memory. You know, in our code, we always construct some data, we obtain references to it, and RISC architectures, as you know, they support only one way of obtaining, of accessing memory, and these are through the load and store instructions. Here in the MIPS case, you see that store words and an example of that store words and store byte instructions. What's interesting and should be mentioned here is that on RISC we usually got only one addressing mode for accessing memory, and this is register base with immediate offset. Spark is no more different than previously discussed MIPS. It also has store instruction and load instructions, so I'll skip it. Again, PRISC has store bytes, store words instruction that is used for storing appropriately byte, word or double word chunks of data into memory. It also has load instruction that is can be used for loading half words, that is 16-bit values from memory. PowerPC is no more different than previously discussed architectures. On alpha, whenever we want to store a given register, we also have to issue appropriate store operation depending on the size of the datum object that is to be stored in a given memory. It can be store a long, store a quad word, or store a byte instruction. On Intel, we sometimes construct data on stack, or data of our codes on stack, and Intel has some pretty handy push instructions that can be used for that purpose. We can push single bytes, we can push the values stored in registers, and the most interesting here is that we can also push the whole 32-bit constants onto the stack. And by doing this, we can, for example, construct a path to the shell program on the stack. And what is interesting and what is the main advantage of such a data construction in our assembly routines is that the stack pointer register automatically points at such a constructed data block. So we don't have to calculate it in any other way. We don't have to obtain, in such cases, the current value of a program counter register. Intel as a CISC has also some pretty nice instructions for accessing memory. The one that I like, the one that is my favorite, is that store a string family of instructions. And we can, with one byte, we can store an 8-bit, 16-bit, or a 32-bit constant into a given memory location. And what's more, we can automatically have a pointer given to that store operation, a destination pointer referencing a memory word to the a given data is to be written. It can be automatically updated with that one byte instruction. Now I will go to the next part. I guess I'm getting a bit run of time. So I would like to present you the technique that we use in our bind and change root breaking codes. This is a technique that greatly influences the length of our codes as they really get shorter. As you know, in order to create a network listening server, you have to create a network socket, and then you must issue a proper bind system call on that socket. And as an argument to that bind system call, you have to pass a pointer to appropriately filled socket address structure. And here you see that socket address structure and its fields. What's interesting here is that not all fields of that structure have to be filled in order properly issue the bind system call. Specifically, we don't have to fill the SINLAN field, as it is only important for local domain sockets. We only have to fill the family, port, and address fields of the socket address structure in order to properly invoke a bind system call. And what we do in our codes, we try to find an instruction for a given architecture, the one that contains in its encoding some values of that socket address structure that we are going to construct in memory. And you will, as you will see in this slide, this is a piece of code that does this is all that is needed to do a bind system call on IRIX MIPS. And to properly fill the socket address structure in that architecture. You see that the first instruction, this is a dummy instruction that we introduced to our code. That instruction doesn't influence its execution in any other way. And it has such an advantage that in this encoding, we have two fields filled of that socket address structure. We got the value of 2, that stands for AF init value, and the 1, 2, 3, 4 values that denote a port number for a socket address structure. Next, we got a branch less than 0 and link instruction that is responsible for providing our code with a position independence capability. It is required as we are going to reference the socket address structure in our code, and we need to know its exact location in our code. And the only thing that is required to finish filling the socket address structure here is this stowaway operation, which puts a 0 byte in the SIN address field of the socket address structure. And this is really all what is required for properly filling the socket address structure for the bind system call. And whenever you want to pass it to a system call routine, we just need to calculate its address by issuing, for example, an add immediate instruction that will calculate the address of a socket address structure according to the current value of a program counter register that in our MIPS codes is usually stored in the return address register. The Spark case and its bind code is no more different than the previously discussed MIPS one. We got a free instruction sequence for obtaining a current value of a program counter register for providing our code with position independence capability. Then we got a dummy instruction that contains again two fields of the socket address instruction in the encoding. And the last instruction is a store instruction that fills the SIN address field of the socket address instruction with a zero value. Again, you can pass it to the system call routine with one simple add operation. We can calculate that the reference to the socket address structure with that one simple operation. I guess I will skip that discussion about of the other RISC architectures and its bin invocation. Let's look at Intel-based operating systems. We can construct socket address structure stack on this system. We just issue two consecutive push operations for that process. The first push operation stores zero value on the stack. The second one fills the port value, the SIN, the SIN address value, and the SIN domain value of the socket address structure on the stack. So we can issue only two instructions on Intel. We got it, the structure is automatically referenced by the stack pointer register and it's ready to use. The only thing that we need to do is to pass it to the bin system call, for example, by pushing it on the stack. The other pretty interesting mechanism that we use is in our change of breaking codes. We notice that all arguments to the functions used in our change of breaking codes contain arguments that are the substrings of the A double dot string. So we once again introduced a dummy instruction to our code, and but with a slightly different purpose in mind. Now we want to have a dummy instruction in our code, the one that doesn't really influence its execution, but gives us the possibility to have in our code that a double dot string already stored in memory. So as you see for MIPS, here we got the first instruction. This is the dummy instruction, and it contains the a double dot string in its encoding. And this a double dot string is all what we need for properly call all the functions in our change of breaking codes. Whenever you want to reference a given substring of that a double dot helper string, we just need to issue one appropriate calculation instruction, like for example a add immediate instruction that would calculate a given pointer to the given substring. We got the very same thing for change of breaking codes again, we got dummy instruction inside our code that is again a double dot. It again contains a double dot substring in its instruction encoding, and again we got the same instruction sequences for obtaining for properly obtaining a given pointers to the substring needed in functions that are called in our change with breaking codes. And again, we just require one proper add operation to calculate such a reference. I guess I will skip that. What's also interesting is that on Intel, again, we don't have to construct that all strings that are needed in the change with breaking codes manually. We just issue two push operations and everything is on the stack already. So we just need to perform one proper move operation to a given register and to pass that register to a proper function from change of breaking code. And this is also done with one byte increment instructions for the Intel 8x86 case. Okay, I guess I will skip the last part about procedures and loops because we are a bit running out of time. And for the final words, I will pass the voice to my colleague.
Okay, just to close our presentation, all these slides we have skipped in our presentation, you can find that in our materials and in the article described in more detailed way. Just for a few words of conclusions. From the technical point of view, in our opinion, writing effective and universal proof of concept codes, exploit and so on, is not as easy task as is always claimed. However, it's also not an impossible mission. What we do like to talk is a sort of art of writing proof of concept codes. We can like to talk about quality of these codes and or some sort of beauty of its code. As for assembly routines, assembly components we were trying to present you in this time, as I told you at the beginning of this presentation, these are the essential parts of or exploits codes and assembly and modern attacks techniques. As I also told you that these routines have evolved in time, I will now say that these routines will be evolving in time, and from some point the sophistication and general attack techniques, attack methodologies will in a significant part rely on assembly components, pieces of code. As for some general conclusions for our presentations, as we are trying to convince you that actual research in the area of attack methodologies is being conducted. And what's more, there are dozens of people capable to prepare an operational code for any discovered vulnerability with assembly components, which are, as we presented, a copy-paste pieces of code. These components there's no need for writing them every time. The exploits, the proof of concepts codes can easily reuse, and in fact they reuse it, these assembly components. What is the consequence? The basic consequence, in our opinion, is that publication of information about specific vulnerability through various mailing lists or various security portals should be assumed as equal to publication of proof of concept, working proof of concept code itself. And from the other point of view, working proof of concept codes is the best proof for existence and the real threat that the given vulnerability represents. And in our opinion, all this stuff, all this information should be well done, well published, and well discussed, as we find it as the only way to increase the practical, I mean real, not the one which is being sold every day, security. Thank you for your attention. Sorry for getting a bit later, as I assume that we are coming close to the critical point of launch. We will skip the potential discussion. It's in case of any question, comments, and so on, we'll be available here for a few minutes, and you will also can find us at our Black Hat conference and DEFCON until end of the week, probably, until Monday. Thank you very much.